Hello, listeners, and welcome to the third edition of the NK News Podcast. I'm your host, Jacko Zwetsloot, and today our special guest is Dr. Georgi D. Tolaraya, currently the Professor of Oriental Studies at Moscow University of International Relations, and also currently Director of the Center of Asian Strategy at the Russian Academy of Sciences. He is a former visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and a retired diplomat, finishing in 2006 as Russian Consul General in Sydney, Australia. Welcome, Dr. Tolaraya, and thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Okay, let's start by talking about the period 1978 to 1980 when you worked as a staff member at the USSR Trade Representation in Pyongyang, North Korea. How was your time there?
Well, that was my actual first visit abroad because in Soviet Union time, we didn't have much possibility to go abroad. This proved to be a fascinating country. I felt as if I got back, well, maybe 30 years and saw the country which my parents, my grandparents spoke about the Soviet Union. It was so, you know, reglemented and it was so, you know, communism-oriented, which was not the case in Soviet Union any longer. Since I've studied the language for 5 years, by that time, I thought that it would be easy for me to get around, but I found out that neither Koreans understand what I say, nor do I understand what they say, at least in full. So it took me, well, several months to get accustomed, and then I have to interpret almost every day and got used to it.
Was that different pronunciations? Is that the reason, or they have a different...
Problem is that way back then, we didn't have enough of the, you know, teachers whose mother's tongue was Korean.
Yes.
We had one or two elder persons,
yes,
who originated from the Koreans which were evacuated by Stalin from the Far East, and they had quite a different pronunciation because they're from northern provinces and also they were cut off from the language for 50 years. At first it was a challenge, but well, it worked out.
Now, as a Soviet in North Korea at that time, did you have diplomatic status or were you
yes.
Okay. Was it easy for you to move around? Did you have freedom of movement and freedom to talk to people who you wanted to talk to and visit the institutions you wanted to go to?
No, of course not. We have to apply for a visit to any institution, and it would take some time before we get the permission. If we would travel outside Pyongyang, except for Nampo, you have to send a note to the foreign ministry. They will grant you permission in 2 or 3 days usually.
Mm-hmm.
But I had some chance to go around with some Russian business delegations because there was loss of trade at that time. Didn't have the chance to go, you know, all by myself. But I visited a lot of places in North Korea, starting from this period.
There were, of course, also North Koreans working at the USSR Trade Representation as drivers and assistants. And
No, we had none.
Oh, I see.
We had none, no. At that time, that was, you know, all the people who would enter the fence of the Russian embassy,
yes,
compound would be Russians.
Ah, okay. All right.
Apart from those who would come just, you know, as visitors,
yep,
to get the visas,
right,
or for negotiations. But usually North Koreans prefer to have their talks and meetings not on our premises, but in the ministries or somewhere.
Yes. Okay.
In the hotels mostly, because most of the talking was at the time done at 3 or 4 hotels,
right,
which was only accessible at the time.
So if you went to, say, for example, Nampo on a long trip, did you have to drive yourself or did a Korean?
No. We had our drivers, we had our cars.
Mm-hmm. And they're all Russian.
And the cars were Russian. Only one guy in our embassy had a Toyota imported from Japan, right, uh-huh, wheel.
Wow. Okay. And so during that 2-year period, what did you learn about North Korea and how did North Korea surprise you?
I saw a country which originated from the Stalinist Soviet Union and stayed there and even increased its, well, repressive character by introducing more rigidness, by introducing more formal and overwhelming control.
Yep.
That was a good, you know, antidote,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
communism, I would say. I would tell it that way.
So before you left North Korea, you were, shall we say, disillusioned with...
Yes, well, I sort of understood that Soviet Union would be going somewhere because the only way the system, the communist system can function,
yeah,
it's the way North Korea did.
Repression and control.
Repression, control, and closeness. And the,
yeah,
Soviet Union was much, much, much more different at the time. It was much more liberal. It was an evolution towards more freedom and more diversity. So that was the first time it came to my mind something has to be done in the Soviet Union, a reform or do whatever, because this kind of communist system can only function the way it does in North Korea.
Now, you returned to Pyongyang 4 years later in 1984 with a new doctorate in economics, and you worked for 3 years as an economist and representative of the Institute of Economics at the USSR trade representation in Pyongyang. So what did you observe at that time? Had North Korea changed in the 4 years that you were away, or was it exactly the same?
Well, first I should explain what Institute of the World Economy and Socialist Economy was.
Sure.
It was, well, one of the institutes at the Russian Academy of Sciences, which was subordinated directly to the Communist Party Central Committee Department on International Cooperation.
Okay.
So we thought we were a sort of think tank for the party headquarters and for the headquarters in general. As such, we enjoyed good access to information, and also one of the channels we had two persons in the embassy, in the trade section and in the embassy, in each then socialist country.
Oh, okay.
So they had access to everything, and that was quite a unique institute at the time. No others had that kind of privilege. We enjoyed some sort of academic freedom, and it was very interesting, you know, to try to find new ways to explore possibilities. And being in North Korea, although I worked at the embassy at the trade section, trade representation, still had some possibilities to express my thoughts, to write something outside of the embassy rules. So it was interesting. The thing that changed over the years that I haven't been there was the dramatic change in Soviet-North Korean relations. Because during my first term, the relations were, well, I wouldn't say icy, but not so close.
Mm-hmm.
North Korea would lean to China then.
Yeah.
And we saw people like, well, Chinese leaders and people like Pol Pot there.
Okay.
Relations with the Soviet Union were, well, very formal.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1984, North Koreans decided to change the course. Kim Il-sung went to Soviet Union and European communist countries by train. He amazed everybody when getting back. He put on a necktie and a suit.
Oh, yes.
He never did before.
Yeah.
And that was seen as a sort of liberalization. And actually, there were some experiments in economy.
Mm.
For example, the joint venture law.
Oh.
Yes, it was published. I remember that I was sort of criticized by my bosses.
Yeah.
Because this joint venture law was published in Pyongyang Shinmun, in a local newspaper, on the fourth page.
Oh, yes.
And we somehow missed it, you know, when reading the paper in the morning. And then we got this information, and my boss called me and said, why do I have to learn about from others, not from you?
Right.
So I remember well that when it was adopted. At the time, there was much more exchanges with the USSR because USSR provided some package of economic aid and military aid, and there were lots of more exchanges. At that time, I had a chance to visit with our delegations remotest corners of North Korea, even going down the pits in Tanchon and,
into the coal mines or the salt mine.
Zinc ore.
Okay.
Zinc ore. Zinc polymetallic ore. And went to different places like Jeju, Sarewon, Sinju, lots of places, and not only just going for sightseeing, but going into the industrial enterprises, meeting the real, you know, North Koreans.
Yep.
Of course, we couldn't speak much to them. They were very much afraid.
Right.
But since I knew the language, at least I could exchange a couple of words, and so they would see that although I'm a foreigner, I'm still a human being.
Yes, yeah.
So that was a shock for many at the time.
By the way, our first podcast guest, Andrei Lankov, was studying in Pyongyang at Kim Il-sung University at that same time. Did you meet each other then in Pyongyang?
I think yes. At the time I was, already a family man and, bureaucratic position while he was just a student. So
sure.
I saw him, but it was later than we started cooperating real in earnest.
Right.
Yes, because there were several students there and they wouldn't venture much to the embassy. They would stay in the Kim Il-sung University where we wouldn't go.
Okay. Now, at that time in the mid-1980s, in your understanding as an economist, was North Korea at that time operating under the principles of socialist economics, or had it already deviated from it?
First of all, we should agree on what principles of socialist economics is.
Sure.
And North Korean operated under the command and administrative system, much along the lines of the Stalinist Soviet Union. It kept pure this theory, like Korea kept pure Confucianism than Chinese did centuries before, so it was logical that any kind of deviation from the system brings actually havoc and bring problems to the livelihood. Mm. However, the shortcoming of this system is it uses their available resources very ineffectively, and there's not enough progress or innovation of any kind. So that's the way North Korean economy operated, and it was a planned economy, but the plan was never fully fulfilled, and it depended much on the imports of raw materials and and technology from USSR and China and other countries, and on the export of its goods to these closed markets, because they couldn't export much to the free market. That was a quite a rigid and artificial system, which was just based on these principles and couldn't progress much.
But what about these 3, 5, and 7 year plans that were always being announced and held up as targets in North Korea? Did you see them as being real or realistic plans, or were they just for show?
Well, no one really knows, because the figures which were published had nothing to do with the reality.
Oh, dear.
Yes, and no one knows how they were implemented.
Yeah.
Because, well, for one thing, the North Koreans kept and still keep all the statistics secret. For another thing, well, also known from the Soviet Union example, when the some kind of enterprise, a plant, is given a planned target,
yes,
it's supposed to meet it, but it never does.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's been changed, it's been corrected,
yeah.
And then even it has changed, the director of the plan tends to just to overdo or to write something in his report which is not true.
So he's exaggerating the figures.
He's exaggerating the figures. Yeah. You know, it goes from bottom to the top.
Yes.
The individual worker tried to exaggerate what he has done.
Right.
The master exaggerates what the unit has done. It goes up to the plant. The plant exaggerates and sends us to the provincial committee.
I see.
So it goes all up.
So every level of the system is exaggerating a little bit more. And so cumulatively, there's a great deal of exaggeration at the top.
Cumulatively, it's not always accurate. It can be accurate, with things like, with physical measurement, like coal, or maybe like iron, or maybe even in this case. But in other cases, it gives a distorted impression of the economy. So I think that even North Korean planners would know exactly what's going on and how it should be dealt with. And they had to take some decisions based on this information.
Yep.
And it led to more problems. So it was the same with the Soviet Union. That's what we tried to deviate from this.
So would I be correct if I assumed that you as an economist pretty much ignored these plans and looked at other information?
Well, the information in North Korea is very hard to come by.
Sure.
You know that. It was at that time even more, because there was no free market. There was no access to, independent information. There were no refugees.
Yeah.
Almost none.
So what were your sources for information then?
Well, first of all, of course, you need to read, North Korean newspapers and open sources very attentively, because you can see the accents changing, and you see being new concepts and being new targets being used. And if you do so day by day, you can feel where the wind is blowing, actually.
Right.
However, to get some hard data, of course, we had our own statistics for our trade. And based on the trade figures, we would know what's going on in certain branches of economy.
Yeah.
If North Koreans lag behind their deliveries, for example, of iron or zinc or lead, for example, we would know there are some problems.
Okay.
Because they got the oil and the needed commodities instead. So they were interested in fulfilling their targets.
Yeah.
So if it was there, well, then you would try to analyze why it happened. Was it because there was some kind of flood on the mine, or there was a lack of electricity, or there was a lack of, you know, transportation capacity, or were all the workers taken to the countryside to help with the harvest, or
right.
to find some natural disaster?
Yeah.
It's a lot of, you know, an investigative job.
Yeah, right.
Also, at the time, we had a lot of Russian technicians working on key objects.
So that they were working on projects, but they would give you some information.
Yes, of course. They would know what's going on exactly, for example, at the Kimchak.
The steelworks.
Kimchak Church also, yes, what's going on there, would say. Well, although they report that the cold roll stock is operating, at least it's not working.
I see.
Because there are problems with, you know, with the equipment.
Right.
So we would know things like that. Then we try to accumulate it, and then we try to aggregate some indices and get the picture that would then go into the report. However, one mistake, well, South Koreans were doing and everybody else was doing was, well, you know, trying to calculate North Korean GNP or growth rate by the methods that you would use in a market economy. There was no such thing as GNP in North Korea.
Yeah.
Because, well, to have this GNP figures, you have to have the market prices,
right?
Or at least some kind of the prices.
Yeah.
And if you suppose that they are equal to the globe, to the world prices, then you're wrong.
Yeah.
Because the structure of the economy and proportion is quite different. So all the figures which are published by the Bank of Korea, by, well, some Western institutions, you know, we just laughed at them because it was just, at least we tried, as we said, to look at the ceiling and get it from there.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They get it just from clear sky because they didn't have an office in Pyongyang. They had no ceiling to look at.
So it sounds like a kind of a detective work to measure the boundaries of the North Korean economy and to realize levels of different factors within that economy. It sounds like quite a lot of detective work that you were doing.
Right, because we had more or less clear picture about the foreign economic relations, foreign trade, apart, of course, from, you know, trade in arms and things like that, mm-hmm. which were, you know, kept secret and kept out of the view of foreigners. And we had some first-hand experience from which we gathered on the ground. So I think at the time, the information we in Chinese well gathered was the most accurate information on North Korea economy which existed outside North Korea, or maybe even within North Korea, as I've explained.
Right. Now, was that around the same time, I'm thinking the mid-1980s, where North Korea stopped paying overseas loans? There were some loans from Scandinavian countries, and I think it was around the same time. Did that...
Right. They didn't pay the Japanese loans. They didn't pay the Scandinavian loans. Although, well, for many years, I used the Volvo cars imported into the slums as a taxis in Pyongyang. That was the main means of transportation in Pyongyang. You would call and get a taxi.
Oh, that would be a Volvo.
It would be a Volvo, yes. So you can go somewhere, have a drink, and not risk, you know, being, you know, getting an accident on your way back if you were driving.
So the loans from Scandinavian countries were used to buy these Volvos,
right,
which you used as taxis.
Right,
okay.
Right. I think some of them are still running. You know? I've been to Pyongyang. I've seen one or two in Pyongyang, a couple of years ago. So that's a good, you know, advertisement for Volvo.
Yeah, they're taking care of those vehicles, yeah. Briefly, how is the North Korean economy today different from the time when you lived there in the 1980s?
Well, it's absolutely different. The economy have undergone a sort of cardinal reform because after the aid from Soviet Union abruptly ended in 1990, the civil sector of the economy just went spiraling down.
Okay.
Almost all of the, you know, these big objects have just stopped working because they had no raw materials, they had no spare parts for the equipment, they had no market to send their products to. So much of the civil sector just stopped working.
Yeah.
It's still much the same.
There's no recovery in that area.
No, in some objects, yes, but much of the objects just stay idle. The Russian oil refinery and many others, it's just, well, either very much outdated and just working on the limits of its capacity or just staying idle. At the same time, the new economy has spread up. The market economy, the grassroots market economy, without any regulations.
Yeah.
That's why, well, maybe in 1990, North Korean economy was the freest one and the most liberal in the world, because right. they had no regulation whatsoever. And this is much of the economy we see now. We see this military-industrial complex, yeah. which is closed and planned, well, more or less works like a big armament corporation. Okay. And with the, you know, intra-corporation communication and planning. And we have this civil centralized sector, which provides for, you know, infrastructure like electricity, like big enterprises, big plants like the iron production or coal mines.
Yeah.
And we have a real free sector, which produces daily commodities, which provides services, which engages in trade both inside the country and outside the country. And this sector is taking more and more in Korean economy and the life of Koreans.
Mm-hmm.
No one can calculate, and as I've said, you don't have any instrument for calculation, because you don't know the prices and
right.
how this price system operates. Although now it operates more or less on market principles, but I think it's taken at least more than a half of the of North Korean economy.
Do you still regularly visit North Korea?
Yes, of course. I try to get there at least once a year. Last time I was there in September, and I'm going again in March probably.
And how are you received in North Korea?
You know, it's now quite easier to get around and easier, you know, to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Because the younger generation, they're more curious about the, well, people from abroad. In the past, if you would ask a North Korean how to get to this place when walking on the street, he would yep. probably run away.
Okay.
These days, sometimes he would answer, and he would even try to hold some kind of a conversation.
You're able to walk around Pyongyang without having a guide with you?
I'm not a guided person. Oh, I'm not okay. a tourist.
You know? So you have a more yes. or less freedom to move yeah, as you wish.
Yes. Well, of course, the North Korean, you know, guards, they're very much surprised. Said, "Where's your guide?"
Yes.
And when you say, I say, I don't have any guide. I don't need one. It's easier for me because, well, we spent so many years there. And
so that's because of your previous status as a diplomat, did they?
Well, because of experience. Of course, I cannot go to the some well, off the limits places.
Sure. Yeah.
But I know my way around, at least in Pyongyang.
Okay, and you can go to shops and
right.
talk with people, buy things, use local currency.
Right.
All the things that tourists cannot do.
Local currency, you know, you don't much use it because you usually get it as an exchange or change it and then spend it.
Yeah.
Well, there's real money now in North Korea. Even the national currency is a currency.
Yes.
It's not just the paper, which it used to be.
Right, yeah. What about the two exchange rates?
Oh, the first one, the official, is just for statistics.
Okay.
You know, just to stipulate the prices in the, well, shops which trade for foreign currency.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be stipulated in dollars or euros or yuan for that matter, but just in some kind of a unit.
Yes.
It's absolutely, it has nothing to do with the real prices. You just divide it by 10 and you get a price in dollars. And right. then you calculate from how much would be in yuan or in euro, whatever.
Okay, and then the free floating exchange rate?
Yes, well, it's there. It's a real exchange rate. You can yes. exchange by this rate at the local currency exchange offices.
Mm-hmm. Some people still call it a black market rate, but you would say it's not really a black market rate. It's simply
a free market rate.
Okay.
And it's very stable, by the way. So I think that North Korean won is sort of pegged
yeah.
to the dollar, one of the few currencies these days.
What's the current free floating exchange rate?
Something right about 8,000, I think.
8,000 won to $1.
I haven't been there for a while, but in September, around 8,000, yeah.
All right, I'd like to talk now a little bit about diplomatic relations.
Mm-hmm.
Diplomatic relations between South Korea and the Soviet Union were forged on September 30th, 1990. And in 1991, you became director of the Korean division at the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So can you tell us about the process of rapprochement between the Soviet Union and South Korea at that time and your role in it?
Well, I wouldn't exaggerate my role, personal role, but I was in this process from the start. There was lots of interest to South Korea way back from, well, 1970s.
Really?
Yes, I remember, my graduation work.
Yep.
At the university was in fact on South Korean economy.
Really?
Yeah.
Your graduate thesis?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Even at that time, there are lots of suggestions from scholars to the government to establish some kind of an official cooperation with North Korea, with South Korea.
Right.
Even well, in the end of 1970s, there were, you know, some movement towards some, you know, trade.
Yeah.
There was, in fact, some trade, because for the third countries, I remember going to a local shop in Moscow and seeing the sweater saying stated Korea, made in Korea. I looked, and it was certainly not made in North Korea.
Right.
And that was just...
And that was when?
It was 1980-something.
Okay.
And so we were actually moving towards, well, more more... closer cooperation at the time. But then this unfortunate incident with the CAL, with the Korean airline, happened.
Yeah.
So it all stopped. It was all frozen, and it was like...
What year was that?
83.
83, okay. That was while you were in the Soviet Union, between your two stints.
Right, right, Canada. Right. Okay. No, I think I was a couple of months before I left for a North Korean mission.
Right.
And then it stopped, and it was only somewhere around 1986 where this movement of rapprochement began again.
Mm-hmm.
There was a decision to permit direct trading between Soviet foreign trade organizations, South Korean companies.
Right.
And then it was... was Gorbachev time. In 1988, yes. The Gorbachev's Krasnoyarsk and Vladivostok speeches, which for the first time said that it's possible to establish relations with South Korea. We took part in the previous Olympics,
yeah.
And the Russian-Soviet team was very popular.
Right.
By the time of the Olympics, we already had some consular group here with Russian diplomats coming here and just making some kind of exchanges.
Right. Right.
And then from 1988, I moved to the then Soviet Chamber of Commerce and Industry, which was not a public organization, actually. That was a branch of the Foreign Economic Relations Ministry.
Okay.
And I became, well, the officer in charge of South Korea. I headed the so-called Business Council between Soviet-South Korean Business Council.
Yeah.
And it was, well, sort of division of the ministry with overseeing the relation, the economic relation with South Korea. And there was a flood of delegation and exchanges.
Yeah.
You know, in our office, almost every day coming a delegation of South Korean businessmen, maybe 20, 30 people, which looked around in bewilderment. And the attraction also was we had a big Lenin picture in the conference hall.
Oh, gosh.
They would see it and they said, okay, let's take a picture. And we would stay under this portrait and take
it.
Maybe still here in the files there, well, hundreds of these pictures of myself staying under this portrait with different South Korean business missions. And also, I still continued as a scholar. Academic exchanges played a lot of role in establishment diplomatic relations.
Well, now, how did North Korea react to this rapprochement?
Well, they were very critical. I wasn't much connected with North Korea then. I mostly spent most of it on South Korea, but I knew from my colleagues in the foreign ministry that they were very critical, very suspicious, and actually they were quite ready for what was going on. Maybe they didn't think that it would go this fast, but they were ready. The crucial points was the invitation of Kim Il-sung to Moscow. That was an affair I took some part in, and I met him then for the first time. When we also, one of our delegations went to Seoul and met Kim Il-sung and others, and I accompanied it. It was headed by the then, you know, Politburo member.
But Kim Il-sung became president here in South Korea in 1993. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So already the relations,
yeah.
And there was already a consul here.
Yes, well, he was very much instrumental in bridging the gap between, well, Soviet leadership and South Korean leadership, because he became the ruling party associate at that time.
Yeah.
And actually, some people here said that without the Soviet activity, he might have become a president.
Oh, really?
Yes. There are some people, I don't know whether it's random, but some people who say that here. And then this rapprochement brought about the meeting of Gorbachev with Not Hau.
Yeah.
In June 1990, and Shevardnadze, then foreign minister, went to Pyongyang, and he wasn't accepted by Kim Il-sung.
Oh dear.
And he said he heard some very harsh words from Kim Yon-nam, then foreign minister,
yeah.
who said
he was here recently.
Yes, right. He's still there. Yeah. I know him for 40 years. I think he's still the same. And then Kim Il-sung told him there about, I think, 6 points. We'll recognize Soviet republics. We'll recognize Japanese claims for territorial. We will do something with China.
Yeah.
And in the condition of existence of nuclear weapons in South Korea, we'll have to take the measures to counterbalance them with the new types of weapons. So that was the first time they officially told us in a direct form that they are working on nuclear weapons.
Right.
Shevardnadze became so furious when he came to New York for the General Assembly sessions, where the agreement on relations was supposed to be signed. When he was supposed to meet South Korean minister, he was brought an article from Nodong Sinmun criticizing this Russia-Soviet South Korean rapprochement.
Yes.
And there was no Korean translator there, so they just tried to get something out of this article, and he understood that he was criticized personally.
Oh, I see.
Which was not there, but which he was enraged with.
Uh-oh.
And when meeting the South Korean president, he said, well, we will establish a relation from today.
Oh.
Not from the 1st of January 1991, as was prepared.
I see. So there was a sudden change of plan because of that Rodong Shinmun article.
Right.
Goodness me. So this is interesting that the Korean division at the Russian Foreign Ministry, which you were at that time director of, changed from dealing with one Korea,
mm-hmm.
which was North Korea. Now it's dealing with two Koreas, North
right.
and South. That seems like a very delicate balancing act.
Well, you know, at first, when there was some kind of restructuring in the foreign ministry, everybody wanted to have something to do with South Korea, and there was an idea that it should be moved into the department which deals with Japan.
Yeah.
And so we say, no. Uh-huh. Well, let's do it like that. And we always dealt in the Korean section has always dealt with South Korea, although indirectly.
Okay.
So we gathered information, we get some analysis on that. So it was always dealing with South Korea, although indirectly.
Right.
In 1988, we have established an office of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
Yep.
Where I worked at the time, here in Seoul, as a first representation. It wasn't in COEX Center. And I was actually supposed to go there to work at this office. But then this whole revolution happened, so it's changed overnight. But we had our diplomats working here in this office as a consular section.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And South Koreans had the same. We sent here our consular officer, who became then minister counsel of the embassy, middle-level bureaucrat, while South Koreans had sent Mr. Kon Nomeon, who became then foreign minister, who was very high-ranking in South Korean diplomatic hierarchy.
Now, later on, so from 1993 to 98, you actually served here as minister counselor. And during that time, while you were here in South Korea, a lot of things happened. Kim Il-sung died in North Korea. Kim Jong-il took over as chairman of the National Defense Commission. Hwang Jang-yop defected to South Korea. And 2 North Korean submarines were caught in South Korean water, with all the submariners dying or killing themselves. So what do you remember most from your time here? And how was the atmosphere for you?
Of course, we enjoyed this atmosphere because, we were finally made it to South Korea. And it was a country unknown to most of the Russians. And there was lots of delegation coming and establishing relations. And we as the embassy had to get lots of new contacts, and we were very much in demand here at the time.
Mm.
There are also very much dramatic events.
Yeah.
That was the first time nuclear crisis of 93-94 broke out.
Oh, I'd forgotten to mention that, yes.
Yes, and I remember when these people around here would run to the shops, buy some ramyeon and, stocks
right.
for the possible conflict.
Yeah.
We never believed there will be conflict. We were amazed at that and a little bit, bewildered that the people here take this North Korean danger so seriously.
Yeah.
There was the events that you've mentioned. Well, I remember when Hans and Jobe defected. I was with my ambassador. I was in Incheon.
Okay.
Incheon, there was the first ever visit by Russian military chief Varag on the celebration of 19th anniversary of the Varag sinking in Russo-Japanese War.
Yes.
At the same place. And we were on the ship, and I had a mobile phone, which was rarity by that time.
Yes.
And suddenly I got a phone call from the foreign ministry here, and they asked me, well, we're looking for ambassador. He's here with me.
Right.
The minister wants to talk to him. I said, well, okay. And I gave the phone to him, and he listened and said, well, they said somebody called Juan Zanyop has defected. Who the hell he is? And I tried to explain, well, as far as I knew.
Because you knew him.
I never met him,
oh,
but I knew in general who he was,
okay,
at that time. And we had to get back urgently to Seoul to meet the minister and, well, get this information. And, well, nobody was quite, in Russia, was quite understandable what happened so much that it would demand that kind of, you know, reaction.
When Kim Il-sung died in 1994, did you at any stage expect that things would change in North Korea, or that North Korea might collapse? You thought it would continue?
Well, it was absolutely clear that the preparation for this hereditary succession of power were well underway, because we've been watching Kim Jong-un's rise from middle 70s, and I was there, and you know, when there were new buildings appeared near embassy, and the North Koreans said this is the center of the party who ordered building this.
Right.
And there were, you know, some new shops and new restaurants, and that was the center of the party who ordered this.
Yeah, so, because the party center was like a secret title, for Kim Jong-il
until he was formally introduced.
In 1980, wasn't it?
Well, no. Later. In fact, when Kim Il-sung went to Soviet Union in 1984, it was Kim Jong-il who, well, carried on all the talks with Russian diplomats about, well, the arrangement of this visit.
Right.
So he was sort of in charge of command of logistics and things like that. So we knew him quite well.
Okay, so you completely expected him to take over and continue to lead North Korea, right?
And we didn't have any kind of doubts that he will manage, that the system will keep on existing, although it will pass a hard time. Now, for 30 years, I've been telling my counterparts in U.S., Japan, South Korea, that don't expect North Korean collapse.
Right.
But we were never heard.
Yeah. Now, near the end of your time at the embassy in Seoul, South Korean President Kim Dae-jung announced his sunshine policy.
Mm-hmm.
Were you hopeful at the time for improved inter-Korean relations? Did you expect to see much result from that?
Well, I met Kim Dae-jung, and even before he became a president, I still hold a calligraphy from him personally. I thought that he was a very, you know, noble person with a great vision, but I doubted that that would get anywhere. Because he was not a bureaucrat, and he had no support from the entrenched conservative ruling class, which was created here over the decades, and he had no support from the U.S. Also, North Koreans were very much suspicious at first of the sunshine policy, because they perfectly seized the idea that the sunshine policy had a sort of hidden agenda to undermine North Korean regime by opening it up. And they were very much suspicious, and they reprimanded us for supporting this policy. Well, never mention this word. Never say anything in support of us, because it's aimed at undermining our republic.
Mm-hmm.
But then the tide changed. North Koreans saw that they could get some profit out of it and get something for their development.
Free things, free money, free...
Not only that, not only machinery. Free things of support, but also some reduction in tension and more the cracks in U.S.-South Korean alliance.
Oh, yes.
So they decided to use it. What they didn't take into account that they would change themselves as well, and it did. But they might haven't thought about it seriously, but I saw how they were changing.
Can you tell us a bit more about that? How did the Sunshine Policy change North Korea?
Well, the North Korean cadres, they saw, you know, different... different country. They saw different option. They became less suspicious to South Koreans. Well, because of this national national identity thing, they started to think differently. And also the population got some wind of, well, how things are in South Korea. South Koreans, well, commodities and things. So it changed the psychology of the country. And I think it's by that time that population and maybe the nomenclature or the ruling class understood, okay, we lost this competition with South Korea. We cannot win in the war with them, but we can do something else. We can coexist and we can keep our identity. I suppose this was a crucial time of national reconciliation, year 2000, this time.
That's interesting. Now, I'm going to fast forward to the current day because we're running short of time now. In an interview with NK News last year, you said that the North Korean, quote, completion of a state nuclear force offers a window of opportunity for dialogue. You said, I believe that this is the perfect chance to start a peace-building process, and if it would start from the Olympics, then that would still be highly symbolic. Now, your statement last December was almost prophetic, since this is more or less what has happened. For listeners, we will link to your December 13th interview on the podcast homepage so they can go back and read it in full. But for us now, would you like to talk about where things are at the moment and how you see things progressing in terms of inter-Korean dialogue and North Korea-US dialogue?
Well, unfortunately, it's the North Korea who are the actor, who are the player, who take the initiatives.
They're in the driving seat, aren't they?
They're in the driving seat. They've always been, unfortunately. South Korea, at least now, has some role in this, you know, in this play.
Yeah.
Because during the late Park Geun-hye era, South Korea didn't have any role. It was just followed the U.S. and North Koreans didn't take South Korea seriously. It has now changed, and North Koreans are using South Korea very effectively, both to state their cause and to, well, to change the strategic situation. And you know that when they one thing move really fast, and you see that they have unexpectedly just yesterday decided to send the high-level delegation here, which I think has started off Pyongyang today. We shall see what they have in mind, because I suppose that they could make some new proposals, new ideas, which would have to get the reaction from South Korea, from the Moon President Moon's government, and it can change the strategic equation. And the crucial issue, of course, is now whether the renewal of U.S. North Korea confrontation will be supported by South Korea or not.
Right.
And whether this U.S. North Korea confrontation would spiral even further, or will the situation will be stabilized. And of course, for that, the U.S. North Korea direct dialogue is essential. And the stumbling block, of course, is the world of denuclearization.
Yes, America wants a complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement, CVID, of the North Korean nuclear program. And you've said before, most recently in your December interview, that this will never happen because the nuclear program is sacred to North Korea.
Right.
So what can the US and North Korea talk about?
Well, my suggestion is, and I made it public today, that they should talk about nuclear program, not denuclearization. But let's meet North Koreans and let them explain. Well, you know, they boast they have nuclear weapons.
Yes.
If you have nuclear weapons, a state with having nuclear weapons is supposed to have some nuclear doctrine. USA has it, Russia has it, anybody has a published nuclear doctrine, part of it's a secret, when, how, and when, and, you know.
Under what circumstances
under what
we
circumstances.
Will use these nuclear weapons,
yes.
That sort of doctrine.
Yes, well, I don't know whether North Koreans have it or not. And nobody knows outside this country whether what's in it.
Yes.
So why not let them just meet U.S. and others and explain what they have in mind? That means that we'll speak about nuclear problem. It could then start with some kind of limitation and with a distant aim of denuclearization many years from now. But the process should be started somewhere.
So it's a kind of a de facto recognition of North Korea as a nuclear power?
Well, it is not, because to be a nuclear power, North Koreans have to be inside the NPT treaty, and they're not going there. And I ask them about that. They say, we don't care about whether anybody recognizes us or not. Mm-hmm. We're not asking to become a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, they say,
right,
as a nuclear power. We're just having it, and we don't care what others say. This issue of recognition is, I think, is just U.S. understanding of the things. If you talk to a country or to some entity which has nuclear power, it doesn't mean that you recognize it. Mm. Because it's there. And you can recognize it, but it's there.
Now, what about a peace treaty between the U.S. and North Korea? North Korea has said for decades that it wants one. Do you believe it actually wants a peace treaty with the U.S.? And is this a realistic aim?
What they want is some kind of recognition. They thought they came close to it in 1994 with the agreed framework. Then they found out they were sort of cheated by Clinton, because what Clinton expected was the collapse of North Korea. And regardless of letters signed by him, regardless of communique they had with Chairman Rock, so they're cautious, but they want some kind of formal recognition,
mm-hmm.
Which is actually normal, because this is the UN member which exists for 70 years.
Yeah.
And U.S. doesn't recognize that such a country exists at all.
Mm.
This is actually ridiculous. You can have much more leverage about a country if you have some at least formal relations, and you can freely talk and not try to avoid each other like Vice President Pence did last time.
But recognition of the existence of the North Korean state by the United States, wouldn't that also be connected to the issue of mutual recognition of the North Korean and South Korean states of each other's right to exist?
I mean, that's purely North and South Korea's business. They can consider themselves parts of the same country. They can consider themselves some kind of special relationship they have, but it doesn't have much to do with the U.S., North Korea, Japan, North Korea relations. Of course, North-South relations are different, and some status can be found here, but it has nothing to do with the formal diplomatic relations of North Korea with other states. After all, South Korea was recognized by Soviet Union and China a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't... who recognized North Korea before that, and that doesn't change anything in the relations in these triangles.
Okay, I'm going to ask my final question now. You've been thinking about North Korea and, both Koreas for 4 decades now. 15 years ago, you co-wrote a slim booklet titled The Ways of Overcoming the Crisis on the Korean Peninsula. And you've also written other similar works looking at short, medium, and long-term options for solving the crisis on the Korean Peninsula. In what ways have your proposals made 15 years ago changed? What would you recommend today?
Well, thank you for reading attentively my work, but I don't remember what was written there 15 years ago. But I would tell you, Frank, that I keep the same position for last 30 years. North Korea will exist. It's our choice whether it will exist as a cornered and hostile nuclear armed now country, which is sort of outcast, outlaw, and now we push them by sanctions into criminal business activity because they won't stop their business, but they will have this, make it criminalized. Or it can be very specific, not approved of, but a country which is recognized,
mm-hmm.
and which can develop and which can gradually evolve, what they call conventionalize, become a normal country. And that's our choice. And I think that the way that we should do, there should be a national reconciliation between North and South, not leading to unification, mm-hmm. in the first stage. North Korea and South Korea should just coexist for some time together. And, the people here will decide whether to unify or not.
Right, but North Korea does talk about unification as an aim a lot. It's in slogans, posters, songs, speeches, etc. Do you think it's really an important goal for North Korea in the short to medium term? Or can it postpone it sort of endlessly?
Well, this is kind of a religion, you know. This is kind of ideology they aimed at. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're serious. Actually, what you find... To find out, you have to talk to them, you have mm-hmm. to communicate, you have to just to find out how serious they are. And the only way is to let these two countries coexist, not necessarily unifying it with each other in near term. After all, you know, people of same ethnic origin coexist in different states. Why don't you unify Australia and New Zealand, for example,
right.
or something like that. So they can coexist, and then they can unify, form a unified state, but before this hostility should go. And to do this, to enable this, of course, U.S. should recognize North Korea and Japan as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be given some space for development. It should be given some security guarantees, which would make their not only nuclear weapons, but further militarization redundant.
Mm.
Because this militarization goes in different areas, and we don't know what will happen next in the cyber war capabilities and others. You know, the world is changing. And if North Koreans remains to be hostile and cornered, it would invent new ways, even other than nuclear weapons, to be dangerous to the world. And nobody needs that.
So recognition, engagement, security guarantees, and allowing North Korea to conventionalize
right.
as a state and develop.
Right.
These are the ways forward as far as you can see.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Professor Tolaraya. We thank you for your wonderful interview with us. And listeners, we encourage you to check back next week for our next NK News podcast. And always look at nknews.org for all your North Korean news. Thank you very much.